This is the Hugo Award-winning SF Signal podcast. I'm your host. My name is Patrick Hester. I'm an author, a blogger, and a functional nerd. And tonight, I am still prepping for Mile High Con 46, which is coming up in just, oh my gosh, it's like the end of the month here. So October 24th, 25th, and 26th. And I'm not getting paid for this, but the kind folks over at Mile High Con asked me if I would be willing to have some other guests of honor on the podcast to talk a little bit about their upcoming appearances. So I said, sure, why not? And tonight I have Michael Swanwick on with me. Michael, why don't you tell folks who you are and what you do?
I'm a science fiction and fantasy writer, and I dabble a little bit in nonfiction. I've written a couple of nonfiction books, something like 8 novels, a couple of 100 short stories, perhaps 1,000 works of published flash fiction.
Oh my gosh.
And I'm just mad about writing. This is, I dedicated my life to writing when I was 17, and I sold my first story when I was 29.
Wow.
So I take literature very, very, very seriously.
And what are you going to be doing at Mile High Con? What is your, what everybody's like a guest of honor of something or other. What's your title?
Oh, I'm not sure exactly what the title is. Literature, fiction, author, guest of honor, something like that.
Okay.
There's so much overlap there. I mean, like the folios are there.
Yes.
So I obviously not the only author guest of honor. There are at least 2 other authors who are guests of honor.
Yes.
So I've noticed that conventions tend to be a little more vague about the titles these days. And with good reason. There's so much overlap.
Yes. So we have Daniel Abraham and Ty Frank are going to be there. They're author guests of honor. Yourself. Now those 2 guys, I figured it out. If you rearrange their names, the letters in their names, it actually spells out James S. A. Corey.
Aha. Uh-huh.
Come on. That's pretty funny. At least in
my
head.
I'm laughing on the inside.
So you've, how do you go about writing 1,000, did you say 1,000 pieces of flash fiction?
Yeah, that is a very good guess. Obviously at some point it become really hard to count up. Essentially, I discovered at some point I just have a natural knack for it. It's very easy for me to write flash fiction. And people started asking me to do it, and it just sort of multiplied. I can write flash fiction in the evening while I'm watching The Daily Show, so it doesn't cut into my writing time. I that sounds cynical, but it's a great pleasure to be able to find another chunk of the day that I can write in. This is my one really great pleasure in life is writing. I wrote a thing called the Periodic Table of Science Fiction. It was like one story for every element in the periodic table, and that was being published online one story a week. And while that was going on, that was for Ellen Datlow. And while that was going on, Eileen Gunn had an online zine called The Matrix at that time, and she commissioned me to do a series. So I did a series based on the 86 etchings of Goyo's Los Caprichos, which were these very dark, fantastic, magical etchings, and they all suggest a story, but they don't give you a story. So I wrote a story for each one of those.
Oh, wow.
And I was doing that at the same time once a week. And I was also occasionally putting up stories on my blog. So the result was when I walked into a room, writers would back away from me in superstitious fear and hold up crucifixes and garlic and such. And I found out when I was doing that the flash fiction is a very difficult form. It's so small. You can only do one thing. It's like, you know, like basically all jokes are flash fiction. So that by itself, a work of flash fiction hardly ever aspires to the state of literature. But if you're doing a couple of dozen or 100 or 200 pieces of flash fiction in one series, they begin to comment on each other. You can have the characters visit each other in the stories, and the thing taken as a whole can then reach up into the holy state of literature.
Wow. Now, the number, the word count for Flash Fiction, as far as I'm aware, is kind of moving a little bit. Some people say X hundred words. Some people say closer to, you know, 200-300. What's your sweet spot for Flash Fiction?
Probably around 300.
Okay.
But the thing is that, you know, with fiction, all of the boundaries are very fluid. So we know that a novel is a very different thing from a short story. But the novella and the novelette, for example, everywhere else but in science fiction, those are terms for the same thing, a work that's sort of halfway between a novel and a short story. And the only reason we have that dividing line between the novelette, which is a short novella, and the novella, which is a long novelette, is that John W. Campbell used to have a little competition, the AmLab in his magazine, and people would write in to say what their favorite stories were, to give them number values, and whoever wrote the favorite story in the issue got more money. And he found that when he did this, that the short stories were all basically decided on merit, but the novellas all went to the long novellas rather than the short ones. So he divided them up into two categories so that the short ones would have a chance to make it on sheer merit.
Wow.
And, you know, similarly, like the line between between Flash Fiction and a short story is just, you know, there's no adjudicating court to decide this. It's all fluid.
So you
could do almost anything.
You talked about carving out time in your day to mm-hmm. write. We're about to attend Mile High Con, obviously. Do you plan on writing at the convention? Because I have seen writers at, for example, WorldCon. If you get up early, sometimes you'll go down in your con hotel and there'll be, you know, writers sitting there sipping coffee and working.
I admire them, but all writers have different styles. And there are many, many, many different ways of writing. I find that when I'm at a convention, I won't be writing at all because I do have the panels to be on. And I want to give them the best. So that creative part of the mind that goes into writing is actually, during the convention, is there on the upcoming panels. I'm trying to think what would be interesting in that, what I can do that I can use to keep the audience from walking out in boredom.
Now, that reminds me, I've got so many questions. What are you going to be doing at Mile High Con? I mean, are you going to have specific panels? Is there going to be like a Q&A session? Are you going to be doing a signing session? Any of that kind of stuff?
There will be an autographing. There will be at least one autographing. I think maybe two, because I believe there's a group autographing. Mm-hmm. I have many panels, all guests of honors to do. The two that stick in my mind, there's one where I and the other panelists will be giving bad advice.
And well, you used to do that on your website, didn't you?
I used to do it on my website. And the basic idea of this is that in science fiction is incredibly hospitable toward new writers. The other parts of writing are not like this. The mainstream people don't knock themselves out to raise up their competition. But science fiction, I've seen published writers spend hours advising unpublished writers. Mm-hmm. That's extraordinary, for free, just out of the goodness of heart. That's extraordinary. And I thought, what fools we are to do this. We ought to be cutting these guys down at the knees. You know, they're young, they're energetic, they're talented. We don't need them going and competing for the limited number of slots in Asimov's. I don't mean that, of course, but I found that when you're clear and upfront that what you're giving is bad advice, all the reader has to do is listen to this and just a little reversal in his or her head, and you actually get good advice. Mm. That said, I cannot think. There's almost no piece of bad advice I haven't seen somebody get away with. I knew a writer who slept with the editor and then wrote a story about how bad the experience was and sent it to the same editor. And needless to say, that did not get published there, but it did get published by an editor who didn't like that particular editor. So
sure.
You can get away with anything.
What's the other panel that sticks out in your mind?
I suggested, and the Folios agreed, I want to interview Phil and Kaja on their plotting, on how they plot. Mm. I stand in awe of Girl Genius and the earlier works too. Phil's and Kaja's ability to just enormous complex wheels of plot. And that's something that's actually very hard to talk about. You can talk about how to create good characterization and how to evoke a scene. You know, there are books about this. It's very, very easy to explain to a talented young person how to do that. But plot is more difficult to explain how to make work. And yet, plot is king. You have a well-written, beautifully written story with terrible plot. Nobody's going to like it. But I've seen stories which were terribly written, but the plot was so good that people love it. And so I really want to find out how they do it, what they do, and maybe learn from them, maybe rip them off for some of their plotting ability.
Well, now, you might argue that other people should be sitting there interviewing you and ripping you off, Mr. Hugo Award winner, Nebula Award winner. Is there an award you haven't won?
Never won the British Fantasy Award.
You get the Theodore Sturgeon. You get the World Fantasy Awards.
I have 5 Hugos. I have a Nebula. This is off to the side, but such a good story, I'm going to tell it. I was in Sweden at SweCon, and one of the fans came up with a fiendish idea for a joke. This was in Helsinki, of course. And he said, we should get our member of the committee with the strongest Swedish accent to call our next guest of honor and say, "Hello, I am calling from Helsinki to inform you of a very great honor you're going to get." And of course, it's Helsinki that the Nobels are mm-hmm. announced from. And I said, "Well, that's very, very funny, but what science fiction writer would actually believe there was a chance they had a chance for a Nobel Prize?" And he said, "Stanislaw Lem."
But see, you said Helsinki, and so I always go directly to Monty Python's Flying Circus on one of their albums that they released. I just remember the line, "Professor such and such from the Going a Bit Red in Helsinki Institute."
Oh, Helsinki is a lovely place, and Sweden is. When we first went there, Marianne was looking around at this beautiful, clean city with no visible crime, no slums, nobody in misery, and said, "Remind me what's bad about socialism." We won't get into politics here, and I will also say that you only have to go to Yekaterinburg in Russia to see what's wrong with socialism. We'll have to cut this part out. I'm sorry.
No, it's all right. So you bring to mind something else. You obviously have traveled for, I'm hoping, for pleasure as well as to attend conventions.
Oh, yes.
Because I see pictures online of you at the 63rd Worldcon in Glasgow. You just mentioned being in Sweden. What is it about the science fiction conventions that make you want to go? Is it just the draw of actually being in panels and being guests of honor, or do you like to go as a fan as well?
Well, I am a fan in the sense that I love science fiction. I love the reading of it and so on. I'm not a fan in the sense that I've never thought of myself as a fan, because I've always thought of fans as people went out and did something in the community. Mm-hmm. And I didn't. I've never put on conventions. I never put out fanzines. I never did all these many good works that the fans do. So I'm sort of a parasitic fan. You know, I take advantage of all their good work. And I say, "Well, thank you for this lovely convention. And thank you for these great panels. And your fanzine is very nice. I loved reading it." I do love everything about science fiction. I love going and meeting the people, the fans in our country, because science fiction self-selects for intelligent, independent thinking, interesting people. So all of that's good for me.
Wonderful. Do you have like a favorite convention moment?
Favorite convention moment. In the late 1970s, I think, or early 80s, I think I had just sold a story, but I hadn't actually had anything in print. And I was standing talking to the Gardner Dozois and and Joe Haldeman, and they were both like 8 feet tall. I was, you know, looking up at them. And George Martin came walking up into the conversation, and he began talking. And he began talking about how he was really concerned the story of his probably wasn't going to get onto the Nebula ballot. And all three of us, myself included, were staring pointedly at his arms because he was holding two separate Hugos at that time. But he didn't get it. And I saw this moment. I had this moment. I thought then, make a note of this. As a writer, you will never be content.
That's funny. So you're going to be at Mile High Con, obviously doing a lot of stuff there. Are you the kind of author who is very open to people coming up and just saying hey and like start talking to you at a convention?
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't have that's why I'm there. I don't have anything better to do.
Well, typically at Mile High Con as well, I know WorldCon and different ones, you know, people try to do this, but I know at Mile High Con, the book vendors in the dealer's room try to have books on hand from the guests of honor, just in case people, you know, want to grab one, buy it, and have you sign it. Do you, during your autographing session, are you going to have books there, or you just encourage people to bring their own?
I encourage people to bring their own. I don't sell my own books. I always say I have people to do this for me.
Gotcha.
Tour books right now, and they do a good job of it.
So what have you got out with tour?
My most recent novel is called Dancing with Bears. Mm-hmm. This is the adventures of Dargar and Surplus, who are postmodern con men. Dargar is kind of a gray, faceless man, nondescript guy, and Surplus is a genetically modified dog. He walks like a human, and he has the intelligence of a human, but he has the features of a dog because that's what he is. And they both exist in the post-utopian future. We achieved utopia, and it fell. And so they live in a world with very high, very advanced biotech, but no electronics, no machinery. There are good reasons for that. And they had in their first adventure in a short story called The Dog Said Bow Wow, they accidentally set fire to London and burned it down. So, and from that time, they've been wandering about the world from place to place. And at the end of the first story, they set out to go to Russia. And I figure if they ever reached Moscow, that would deserve a novel. And so this is the novel. This is what happens to them when they arrive in Russia. And it's the two of them against Russia, and they're going to find out that Russia is bigger and meaner than they are.
Well, you also have a collection of your short stories.
They mean the best of Michael Swanwick?
Yes.
That may be sold out, although I believe it's still available in ebooks. That is a good collection. Okay, I'll say this. I've been published for a third of a century.
Wow.
And I've written some very good stories then. They told me what length I could have. And it's a big, fat book. And I went through, and I'm very proud to say that everything in there is, by my standards, a first-rate story. I didn't have to fill it in with something that's also just merely good. These were the best stories I ever wrote. So I'm really quite content with them.
And just looking at the table of contents here, you've got, I'm going to have a hard time pronouncing some of these, aren't I? The Feast of St. Janus?
Janus. Yes, it's after Janis Joplin.
Oh, okay. And then, yeah, Ginyungab. Gagap.
Mm-hmm.
Trojan Horse. A Midwinter's mm-hmm. Tale. The Edge of the World. Griffin's Egg. The Changeling's Tale. North of Diddy Wah Diddy. Now, what is North of Diddy Wah Diddy?
When you die and go to hell, the stations of hell, there's Hell, West Hell, Beluthahatchee and Diddy Wah Diddy. Ginny Gall, Beluthahatchee and Diddy Wah Diddy. This comes from Zora Neale Hurston's Dictionary of Harlem Slang. It's old African-American folklore.
Hmm.
So if you ever hear the song, I wish somebody would tell me what Diddy Wah Diddy means. That's what Diddy Wah Diddy is. It's three station stops west of hell.
How about you have a Hugo Award winner in here, Scherzo and Tyrannosaur?
Scherzo and Tyrannosaur, yes. That was one of my fascinations is dinosaurs. And I was about to embark upon a novel which came out called Bones of the Earth about some paleontologists who become stranded in the Cretaceous. And I wrote that story as an experiment to put together some of the mechanics of time travel that I was working on. And that won the Hugo. I was very happy with it. What I was really happy with was I got to spend a year hanging out with paleontologists. and I traveled about, I would travel a couple of hundred miles to go look at one fossil. And by the time the year was over, I could sit in on any conversation with any paleontologist in the world and follow every word of what they said. I could not contribute to the conversation, but I could understand it. And so that was for Science Geek. That was really quite a delightful experience. I went and interviewed people at the Smithsonian. I saw John Ostrom, who is probably the most important dinosaur scientist of the 20th century and now early 21st century, receive a standing ovation at a symposium in his honor. And how often do you get standing ovations at scientific symposium? It was just a wonderful experience.
Very cool. What about from Babel's fallen glory, we fled?
That's a result of, I occasionally teach at Clarion or Clarion West and once Clarion South, very, very occasionally. And one thing that struck me was that the new writers don't realize how important a title is. So they tend to have very dull title, you know, the package, gravel, a roadway, you know, where it's a really great title, something like Time Considered This as a Helix of Semi-Precious Stones, or I Have No Mouth, But I Must Scream. These are titles that you remember, and titles that leap out and say, read me, maybe the rest of the story will be as good as the title. So this one I actually started from the title, and I said, it's my homage to early Samuel R. Delaney. I decided to just see, to make it as baroque and ornamented a prose as I could, and make it as interesting and as much fun and as elaborate as I could. And for the background world, well, I had an idea for a hard science fiction novel, and I worked on it for something like 2 years while I was doing, you know, other business too. And at the end of the 2 years, I realized that I had set this. I had just created all these worlds and societies and names and such. And the one thing I didn't have was event. I didn't have any plot whatsoever. So I said, time to write something else, and did. And I set that all aside. But out of a sense of economy, I took all that. Creation and ideation I had for I'd worked on for 2 years, and I put it into a story.
What inspires Michael? I mean, where do you said that you'll sit down at night and you're watching the Daily Show, you're doing a little flash fiction. What sparks that creative node that makes you go, oh, here's where I need to write?
What sparks it is the same thing that sparks a reader. You go, this is cool. This is neat. This will be really terrific, and then when you get something that you think is neat like that, you play around with it. And most readers are not in a position to create a story around those images. Like I said, damn, I'm sorry, nobody wrote a story about that because I'd love to read it. And an author gets to say, okay, I can write this story. A good example is The Iron Dragon's Daughter. I was driving to Pittsburgh to visit my mother-in-law. And I was driving along, and Marianne, my wife, and I were talking about fantasy novels, and we were talking about locomotives. And I made a joke about the Baldwin Steam Dragon Works, and she laughed. And we drove along for a while, and I said, "Write that down for me, would you?" Because I recognized that was an idea, and from that little nugget is what came the entire novel.
That's awesome. And it's kind of hard to encompass your entire career in a 30-minute interview. You've written so much, like you said. And is there any, you know, like what's next? What's sitting on your to-be-written list?
Oh, man, a lot of stuff. I just finished a novel, and I sent it in to Tor. They're going to publish it, I think, next year. I've got to nail that date down. Called Chasing the Phoenix, which is another Dargern surplus novel. This is very strange to be writing two series novels in a row, because I've never written anything series before, really. It just came from the hindbrain. And doubly ironic, because I'm working on the third Dragon novel, Iron Dragon's Daughter. A few years ago, I had an image of a boy seeing dragons flying overhead and just running to the top of the hill so he could feel the heat of their afterburners. And from that came a novel, which is sort of the opposite of The Iron Dragon's Daughter. And The Iron Dragon's Daughter was about a girl who had been captured by the elves and forced to work in a factory building dragons. And as she grows up, she escapes, and she tries to find a place for herself in that world. But there is no place in that world for her. What she needs is she needs to escape the world entirely. And in the second book, which was the Dragons of Babel, sort of the opposite of that one, and that was a boy who did belong in that world. His role was to find a place in that world. And now at the third Dragon book I'm working on is sort of thesis, antithesis, synthesis. This is one that's going to sort of explain the other two and encompass them and close the whole thing down, so that there will be no more of those novels ever again, I promise.
Now there were 10 years between those two novels, though, wasn't there?
Oh, yes. Those are standalone novels. They're never. It doesn't matter which order you read them in. And, there's a lot of time between them because, as I say, they were not intended to be a trilogy. But once you have two, it's almost impossible not to have a third.
Well, that sounds awesome. You've also got... I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I was going to say, I should probably mention, I forgot to say earlier, about things that I'll be doing at Mile High Con.
Sure.
I will also be electrifying a pickle. So that will be well worth seeing.
Electrifying a pickle.
Yes. I've used this. I've taught this in fourth grade science classes. It's a wonderful way to open up science to bright young minds, and that includes adult bright young minds. So that should be fun.
So you didn't want to do the potato clock?
No, this is better. This is far better. I promise you.
Well, that's very cool. I just wanted to throw out there also Stations of the Tide.
Mm-hmm.
So you kind of go back and forth between fantasy and science fiction.
I do. And I also tend to mix them. Stations of the Tide is kind of a fantasy-flavored science fiction novel. Mm-hmm. It feels a lot like fantasy. And Iron Dragon's Daughter was sort of a science fiction-flavored fantasy novel, because it's all about technology, machines, and so on, things you don't normally have elves interacting with. For Stations of the Tide, I set out to have a work of magic in every chapter. I set the standard that it had to be something that Isaac Asimov would agree was possible in our universe. So it starts with a piece of stage magic in the first chapter, and by the time you get to the end, you're into tantric sex magic. So that was when I was writing that, I thought, nobody's going to understand a word of this. I was writing about black constellations and a great deal of mysticism in there, and it turned out to be the most intensely understood thing I've ever written. People don't want me to tell them anything about it, because that would ruin their understanding of it.
Hmm. Very cool. Well, Michael, I promised you about 30 minutes, and we're right up on that now. So I did want to ask you just a couple more questions. When you're at Mile High Con, remember to drink lots of water.
I will do that.
Remember that the authors who live here, if you go to the bar, they can drink you under the table.
I've been to Russia, so this is no new experience for me.
Okay, so you have been warned about these things.
Okay.
Okay. So now your website is michaelswanwick.com. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And do you go ahead.
I'm on Facebook and Twitter as Michael Swanwick. Mm-hmm. And I have a blog, which is floggingbabel.blogspot.com. And that name came up because I created it back when I was when the Dragons of Babel was new, and I was and I said, well, if I'm going to be promoting the novel, I'll be open about it. And so now it's kind of a fossil name. I'm kind of amazed that nobody has ever come in and said where's the S&M? What a deceitful title. But
I can't imagine them saying that. No.
Very cool. Oh, and I should probably mention that I'm going to be at Falcon in November.
Okay.
Falcon is in Lublin, Poland.
Oh, wow.
And that is going to be, yeah, it's going to be an incredible experience for me. I've always wanted to see Poland. And I'll be staying for a couple of days, and I'll get to see a very, very, very small bit of it. So I'm very excited about that.
Very cool. What are you going to be doing over there? Are you an author guest of honor as well?
Yes, I am.
Very cool. Well, wonderful. I wish you well on your trip. Can't wait to meet you in person at Mile High Con 46. Is there anything else you'd like to tell our listeners before I let you go?
Read lots of science fiction and subscribe to at least one magazine.
Okay, there you go. Do you have a preference?
No, they're all good.
They're all good. One other thing I just remembered. Are you going to be going to any of the local bookstores like Tattered Cover or anything like that when you're here?
Knowing me, most likely.
Very cool. All right, Michael Swanwick, thank you for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to the Hugo Award-winning SF Signal podcast. Your host is Patrick Hester, an author, a blogger, and a functional nerd. His website is www.atfmb.com, which stands for All Things From My Brain. ATFMB is also his Twitter handle and where you can find him on Facebook. Our podcast is available for download every week at sfsignal.com or via iTunes. Look for the links to subscribe in the sidebar at sfsignal.com or search SF Signal in iTunes. If you enjoyed this podcast, please tell your friends and have them tell their friends and so on and so on. Visit the Hugo Award-winning sfsignal.com for all of your speculative fiction needs. John D. and the SF Signal regulars offer up new content every day, from weekly mind melds featuring your favorite authors, editors, and artists from the SF and F field, to book reviews, original articles and essays, fiction deals, movie reviews, videos, links and roundup posts, and more. Click the RSS button in the sidebar of your browser to ensure you never miss a post. The SF Signal podcast is powered by the Functional Nerds.
Romeo, Romeo, wherefore art thou, Romeo?
Angry robot.
Magic Wooey.
Wah, wah.
Thinking and crap.
And scene.